You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
Now, they're saying I should think stuff like this. They're saying
something is wrong with me.
Practice.
Welcome to another edition of Positive Cynicism. Before I get into the show, I just want to remind you that now the Positive Cynicism website, which is very easily found, it's www.positivecynicism.com. Two simple words, not hard to misspell at all. It is open, it's online. The merchandise store is yet to open up. Hopefully that will be coming. Well, probably, maybe in the next year. Not coming anytime soon. Unless you want Positive Cynicism merchandise, in which case, send us a message, hit me up on Twitter, at Chad Smart, and let us know if you are interested, and we will get merchandise made if there is interest in people actually buying it. But there is no merchandise as of now. But if you go to PositiveCynicism.com, we do have not quite daily blogs yet, but Monday through Wednesday are pretty much taken care of. Monday is MySpace Memories, where I pull out old MySpace blogs from 13 years ago when I was all emo and edgy and young-ish. And I look back and see where my life was then and where it is now and try not to get too depressed. And then speaking of depressed, on Wednesdays is Battling with Depression blogs, where I open up about my battle with depression, and that's fun too. I try to take a lighter look, but you know, it's all about being positive and being honest. Those are the two things that we strive for here at Positive Cynicism. This week, or this edition of Positive Cynicism, question everything. I have a good friend on to talk about a book that he recently wrote and published, and which you can buy on Amazon and probably other book dealers as well. We'll have a link to it on the Positive Cynicism website as well as the Facebook page. So if you are interested after hearing the interview of checking out this book, I highly recommend it. It's a quick read, so if you're thinking, I don't have the time to read this book, trust me, two, three days, you can get through this book easily. I highly recommend it. It is a good story, entertaining, and well-written. So after this commercial break, stick around for the interview with Travis Yates, and we talk about his book, No One Told Me My Legs Didn't Work.
Hey everyone, Kevin Huntsberger here from My 123 Cents, the podcast, and my123cents.com. Every Monday, a new episode drops with the latest news and happenings in the world of professional wrestling. Head to the archives and listen to interviews with legends of the ring like Double J, Jeff Jarrett, Mick Foley, Kamala, and Dan the Beast Severin. Current superstars like Sheamus, Xavier Woods, and Kofi Kingston have been part of the discussion, too. Again, it's My 123 Cents, the podcast, a wrestling fan's perspective.
What is the meaning of life? Do aliens exist? How much wood can a woodchuck chuck? Why do superheroes wear their underwear on the outside? It's Question Everything. In the hot seat tonight, professor and author Travis Yates.
I am joined once again by Travis Yates. He has been on the show a couple times. So, Travis, welcome back.
Thank you, Chad. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited about this time. This one, I mean, granted, I think the Mr. Rogers episode that we did a few months ago was probably one of the best episodes. And if there were podcasting awards, which I'm pretty sure there are not, otherwise would have won one already.
I imagine there are. Let's look into that.
But I think that episode would have been a good one to at least get, you know, to at least be able to say it was nice to be considered.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to getting into our topic tonight, our conversation. I mean, this is Question Everything. So even though we do have a focus, it's really anything that comes up. And so I have two thoughts I want to start off with that have nothing to do with the main topic. We are recording this on August 9th, the first night of the NFL preseason. You are a recent, within a year or so, transplant from Illinois down to outside Miami. So you, as a Miami Dolphin fan myself, you have said that you're going to kind of follow the Dolphins this year.
So I am, and again, this fits with the question everything motif of the show, because I am a 22-year fan of the Cincinnati Bengals, and that's a long, burdensome road to travel, and I started a few years ago to question everything about the team's loyalty to its fans.
Mm-hmm.
And that essentially, coupled with the move down here being very close to an NFL team, where I was 7 hours away from Cincinnati, it just was the perfect storm. And I described it as a divorce from one team, because they're literally everywhere in my house and in every room. And I just finally felt kind of fed up as a fan. I didn't feel like I was getting back what I was putting in. And so here we are now, close to Miami, and I know you, and I know a couple other longtime Dolphins fans, and it just felt right. So I put the orange and teal on for the first time tonight, and it felt pretty good.
Okay, as we're recording this, I checked the score, and the fourth quarter was about to start, and the Dolphins were losing. So I just want to make sure that you're aware, this is pretty much how the season goes.
Great. good to know ahead of time.
Yes, you know, it's like the Gin Blossom say, if you don't expect too much from me, you might not be let down.
Great. So. Well, at least I can go to the games and enjoy watching them lose in person now. So there's that, right?
There you go, yeah. A game is always better in person.
Always.
Or at least that's what Rams and Chargers fans keep telling me, but I still don't go to those games. Waiting on the new stadium to be finalized.
Yes.
And then I'll go when WrestleMania is there. Not for a football
game. I didn't know they were getting that.
They're not, but I would assume, you know how Vince McMahon likes to get into football stadiums early to set the record.
Yes, and something new and shiny, so.
Exactly. My second topic question, I know you are a professor of communication, television, you know, you studied film and television in college. What are your thoughts on the recent change to the Oscars to add a popular movie category?
I don't like it.
Does anyone like it? I have not heard one positive feedback to it.
Well, and there's some research out there that shows the box office numbers of Oscar winners compared to the highest grossing film like each year. And it is exactly what you would expect it is, because the blockbusters that are made for the masses that are just pure enjoyable fluff,
mm-hmm.
That are so formulaic, that's what sells, obviously, and so that gets the box office numbers. But I thought that the Oscars were more about the artistic side of the film industry, and I think by adding a most popular film, you start to lose that, and it's a slippery slope. We're starting with most popular. You know, where do we go from there?
Yeah, and my question, which I have not read really anything about this other than Twitter comments and headlines, is what qualifies as a popular film? So you look back 20 years ago, Forrest Gump was your top rated highest grossing film in 94, I believe. That won Best Picture, Titanic in 99. So would these movies be eligible for both categories then, or how do we separate it? And what is the definition really of popular versus something that is artistic? So what if the example I used today in conversation was Bohemian Rhapsody, because I think that's definitely an Oscar geared film that's coming out in the mm-hmm. fall. What if it actually succeeds and is popular?
Yeah, I don't know how else besides box office you would judge a most popular category. That's something that's very intangible and hard to wrap your mind around. So, I certainly think that it would be and should be eligible for multiple categories, much like other films in the other categories. They're eligible for all the categories, but I'm curious, and I didn't read a whole lot either about if there was even a process decided upon yet on how that would be judged. But let's watch with bated breath and see what they decide there. But you know, give them a Moon Man or something instead of an actual Oscar. I don't know, but it'll be interesting to see the backlash if this is a 1 year kind of experiment or if it becomes a staple.
Yeah, I do think it is becoming the MTV Awards or the People's Choice Awards. You have those.
Right. So let's keep those separate.
Exactly. Yeah, well, it'll just give something else for people to complain about the Oscars. So
maybe they just needed to get it, you know, all the way till 1 a.m. Eastern time. Oh, yeah. And, is ending too early at 12:30.
So. I don't know. Anyway, let's get into the topic at hand. The reason why you're here, not that we don't like having you back anytime to expound on topics, because, again, I think we've had some good conversations in the past. Check those out in the archives. But tonight we're here because you have done something that is on my bucket list, and that is you've published a book, which actually I guess is your second book. Sorry, I didn't realize you had a first book out. I didn't have a podcast didn't promote it.
And the first book is a collection of essays and various things that I've written about film through the years. So that's more of a cold collection that's available in print and digital. But this is an actual narrative from start to finish that I sat down, and it's a memoir of sorts, of course, but it's written kind of like a narrative, like a fictional narrative. You could essentially call this my first book, I suppose.
Well, I will. For the sake of argument, I will call this your first book. And because I am bad with titles, I will let you state the official title of the book.
So the title is Nobody Told Me My Legs Don't Work. Subtitle, Journey of a Down Dog. And I really went against all of the publishing rules of, you know, keep it simple, keep it easy, roll off the tongue. So what do? I try to squeeze as many words in there as possible. But it was the only title that does the story justice in my mind.
And just for people listening, wherever you're listening, let's clarify, this is not the inspiration for the new Joaquin Phoenix, He Won't Get Far by Walking movie. And
correct.
To my dismay, it was also not the basis of the new film Axel, AXL, which is about a robot dog.
Correct. Although the cover does have quite the contraption on the dog, which my dog had as well. It is not a cyborg dog by any stretch of the means.
Yeah, I was 90% through the book and there were no cyborgs. I thought I picked up the wrong book. Anyway, well, give us a overview of the story.
Sure. So several years ago, let me go back even further. My wife and I have spent years rescuing, trying to, and homing animals or rehoming them. Some we would keep and some we would find homes for. And eventually it got to the point where they would just seem to find us. You know, that happens with people that do that, I believe. But so one of our dogs had an accident of which we never really found out the cause, but some incident happened and she suffered a spinal stroke, which essentially means that something lodged into her spinal cord and the blood flow stopped right around her shoulder blades, her upper shoulder blades of her front legs. And so no blood flow was going to the back, and slowly but surely she lost the use of pretty much the lower half of her body. So she became what they call a down dog, which is a handicapped dog that cannot walk. And the book is essentially our attempts at rehabbing her and getting her back on her feet again.
Interesting. Yeah, I remember you talking about this when it happened. I didn't realize that it has been 10 years ago now. If my math is correct from the book.
That is correct.
Yeah. And how long... Well, let's start at the beginning, I guess. When you took her to the vet to see what the problem was, what the prognosis was, what was your initial reaction and game plan?
So it all happened so fast. She'd been kind of favoring one of her legs for a few days, but that was the only signal we had that anything weird was going on. And so I'd thought about taking her to the vet if she didn't improve. And I came home for lunch one day to let the dogs out. We had, at the time, we had 9 animals in the house and 4 dogs. And so I came home to let the dogs out, and she did not come down with the other two. And so that's very rare. And so I went upstairs to find her, and she was at the top of the stairs, and she couldn't move. And so, you know, she was fine in the morning. So in the span of a half a day is when obviously the full blockage occurred, and she'd lost some of the use of one of her legs. By the time we got to the vet, in less than an hour, she was now falling down on her back legs, no longer able to support herself. So it happened very quickly. The real challenging part in those first few days was that we were in a small town in Illinois, Quincy, at the time, and they did not have the technology available to really do the full scope of tests that they needed to do to find out what was going on. So they did a couple things. They first thought it might have been a rare tick bite that can cause paralysis in dogs, so they did a blood test on that. You know, they tried to make her comfortable. They had to keep her there. This was a Friday, so they had to keep her over the weekend. She needed an MRI, an animal neurologist, which I didn't even know existed until this happened. So many things I learned from this experience about animals and the certain types of care that's out there for them. The neurologist was in St. Louis, and we weren't able to get into them until the following Monday. So we had a full weekend with her at the vet. You know, we were able to go visit her, but unable to, you know, to be with her. We didn't know why this was happening. It was all very scary. Our Quincy vet was unable to give us a prognosis. Set us up with the animal neurologist in St. Louis for that following Monday. So those were the first few very scary and emotional days of just not knowing what was happening.
And at any point, was there consideration, and maybe this will come in later after you found out what the prognosis was, but was there any thought of putting the dog down, or were you like, whatever it takes, we are going to do whatever we can?
Yeah, that first weekend, we just naturally, both my wife Renee and I both naturally gravitated towards whatever we need to do to make her comfortable, to make her, you know, safe and get her healed, essentially. And so we both made plans with our works. We let them know what was going on, and thankfully, we both had very understanding bosses that, you know, let us kind of just do what we needed to do at that time. And so we didn't know until Monday morning that we could get in with the neurologist in St. Louis. So that was our first kind of at the drop of a hat, we're just doing whatever we can. So we told our Quincy doctor, as soon as you can get us in, let us know and we'll drop everything and go. And so first thing Monday morning, that's when we did that. So yeah, there was immediately just a, you know, we're going to do whatever we have to do to help save our dog.
Okay. And just for people listening who aren't familiar with the area, the landscape, Quincy to St. Louis is a 2.5 hour drive.
Yeah, depending on traffic and conditions, 2.5 hours. Yeah.
And this also happened in the wintertime, so you're not dealing with the best of weather conditions to begin with.
Yeah, this was the end of January. In fact, it happened on my wife's birthday, so there's a funny little anecdote in the book about the gift that I gave her that night, that after we had to leave our Keegan is our dog's name, we had to leave her at the animal hospital, and it was a very poor timing, which I had no way of knowing it would be poor timing. It was a well-intentioned gift, so but yeah, it was you know, towards the middle of winter, and not the best time to be traveling up and down the highways of northeast Missouri.
Yeah, because I was gonna say, with the trip being 2.5 hours one way, and you not knowing what, you know, what the neurologist was going to tell you, or, you know, I guess this comes back to my previous question, is if they would have said, you know, you have to come bring the dog in 2 or 3 times a week, or leave it here for a week, which you, ultimately end up doing with one of the places you ended up going. But I guess what was the was there more talk about this the I don't want to say the stress of what would it mean if you had to keep going back and forth to St. Louis, or what the plan would be?
No, you know, the initial stress was financial. You know, we were both still kind of young, just started paying off our student loans, still, you know, very young into our careers, and so we weren't making a lot of money. We had just bought a house a few years earlier, and you know, we were a couple years into a 30-year mortgage. So, you know, we didn't have a huge safety net, and we burned through it very quickly in this process. So really, the initial stress was more financial. The rest, you know, I kind of went into autopilot, and you know, if I'm going to St. Louis, I'm going to St. Louis, and you know, I'll talk to my work. If I can't, then Renee, you can, and we did that as well, the back and forth we had to, and so most of the trips were solo. Only those first few trips to St. Louis were done together, and then after that, we were flying solo. So no, it was the biggest question mark was, how are we going to do this financially? Which, you know, also hung over our head for a long time and really made us, again, question how are we going to manage this, first financially and then eventually and emotionally. And then finally, it was the very last thing was the, you know, kind of more the physical toll that it mm-hmm. eventually took on us.
And you mentioned you had several other pets at home at the same time. What effect did that have, or what thought process went into, you know, now we have this dog that's going to need possible round-the-clock care. How do we fit that in with the other animals to make sure that everybody is taken care of and you know, well exercised and well fed?
Yeah, it was tough. You know, fortunately, it was a double-edged sword. Fortunately, we had a house that was perfectly suited to care for a handicapped dog with a downstairs that was separate and a walkout basement. So, you know, we talk constantly about how lucky we were that we had the setup there to do that. But yeah, absolutely. We had other rescues and, you know, this was, you know, this is before we had any children and we, you know, the dogs and the cats were our lives. And, you know, we just loved them and loved rescuing them and caring for them. And so certainly, you know, we talked about how the other dogs were going to have to be neglected a bit during this process. And that was just kind of one of the things that we were going to have to live with and you know, down the road, try to make it up to them, I guess, with a lot of extra love and a lot of extra attention. But certainly it was discussed and it was just kind of decided that, you know, to go all in, to try to find a way to help Keegan, we were just going to inevitably have to neglect the other dogs. You know, we did our best, and certainly we gave them love and attention and walks whenever we could. But certainly they were kind of, you know, looking at us like, hey, you know, what about me? What do I have to do here? So that was tough emotionally as well.
So in the book, though, you do keep a Keegan journal. You have at the end of every, I think most of the chapters, you kind of sum up what Keegan went through. Was that something that you, I guess this 2-point question, when did you plan on writing the book? And was the Keegan journal something you added for the book in hindsight, or was it something you kept as you were going along?
That's a great question, Chad. So the Keegan journal is actually something that Renee kept. So those little excerpts were actually written by her. And let me go back to then your second question. As soon as she started to show improvement, I knew I wanted to tell this story. And it was funny because I went back and looked at the local paper did an article on us midway through her rehab, and I mentioned the book and the title back then. And this is 2009. So I knew I didn't want to really entertain it until I knew that she was going to have quality of life. Mm-hmm. And once she did, then I kind of started the writing process of really keeping an intense journal of you know, the different types of rehab we were doing and the raw emotion that was there, that sort of thing. Now it's been, like you said, 10 years. It's been a very long process, but as I finally sat down to finish it all, I just kind of felt something was missing, and then that's when Renee mentioned, you know, what about telling some of it from Keegan's point of view? And I said, well, you've got that journal. Let me take a look at that. And so she gave me what she had, and I thought, well, this might be kind of neat little checkpoints along the way from her mm-hmm. point of view.
Yeah, no, I think it added to the story and was a cute little anecdotal point to put in. So kudos for that one. Good job, Renee.
Yeah.
Now, one of the other things that you mentioned, though, is, you know, I don't know how many people have had to deal with a down dog or a stroke victim. And you talked about when this first happened, going online and finding, you know, doing research and finding a message board for people who had similar experiences. How valuable was that? And did you make any contacts that, I guess, you've kept through this process?
You know, it was interesting in the internet was compared to what it is now. Even just 10 years ago, it was still relatively in its infancy, so to speak. I mean, Facebook was only a couple of years old. There wasn't Twitter yet, or if it was, it wasn't anything like it was today. So the social media aspect wasn't there. And yeah, the social media essentially back in 2008 was message boards. And the internet was a saving grace for us on a number of levels. One, from just doing some research to find out on my own. It's the question everything. So, you know, once we finally, let me backtrack a bit to when we finally met with the animal neurologist and they gave us the official diagnosis, and they showed us even on the MRI results of where the blockage was, and it was that was the darkest point of the whole process for me, and that was when we were told she'll never have quality of life, you should put her down, it's not fair to keep her alive like this. It was not a great experience, and the way we were treated, and it was just a very cold experience overall, and by far the darkest point for me. But then once I got out of there and, you know, I literally carried my dog out of the hospital and back into the back of our SUV and then back from St. Louis to Quincy, you know, I just decided, no, I refuse to accept, this diagnosis, this prognosis. And, I'm going to find a way to fix this. You know, it's just kind of in my nature to want to fix things, and so I refused at that moment to accept what I'd been told. And so I hit the internet to start doing my own research. And you know, there were some start and stops. There were a few things that I left out of the book that you know, I there was a doctor, ironically, down here near Miami, which where I live now, and who he had a supposedly this like solution that made that other people had success with their handicapped dogs, but it was a weird situation when I contacted him, and he wanted me to like submit money for shipping, and it just felt scammy to me. It didn't seem on the up and up, and so I didn't pursue that, and so there were some start and stops with potential treatments that I thought, but then eventually, yeah, I found the message boards on a website called handicappedpets.com, and I started reading these cases, and they were exactly like Keegan's, and some didn't end the best, but others did. And so what I started doing was focusing on the cases that did end well and tried to find a theme there. And the running theme was staying completely positive, trying to keep life as normal as you can for your dog, and keeping the positive energy flowing in your home while you you know, try to rehab the dog. And so that was kind of my first step after that dark moment. I didn't know yet what we were going to do, but I told Renee, whatever we do, we've got to keep things positive for Keegan. She's doing her best. She had no control over her bowels. It was a messy affair anytime we walked in the door. But so that's what we started with. And then eventually the internet led us to a doctor in Union, Missouri, which is a little further south of St. Louis, who works with handicapped animals. And she ultimately ended up being our saving grace and showing us things that we could do with Keegan. And ultimately, we worked with her for almost a year. But, you know, had I just accepted on face value what this initial expert, quote unquote, in his field had told us, then, you know, we'd be one less dog and, you know, she would have not had another great 6 years of her life.
No, I think that's I want to stress that because obviously with the show, the aspect of positivity is a very key component. And I think in life in general, that's basically how you get through a lot of things is you have to keep that positivity. And, you know, once you let the circumstance get to you, that's usually when you see failure.
That's a great point, Chad. You know, there's two ways to look at this, and we could have looked at it as, oh man, you know, what did we do to deserve this burden? We've been rescuing animals. Why in the world would this happen to us? And look at, you know, the money that we're having to just pour down the drain in order to try to fix this. You know, it's not fair. Or, you know, take the approach that I took for both her, for our family, and then ultimately to tell what I think is a wonderful story that I hope is inspiring to people that read it. And there's certainly, you know, you can look at it either way.
Yeah, and I think now looking back, again, with the 10 years of hindsight, with the book out now, maybe this is, you know, why you went through it, so that you have this experience, so you can help others that are going through the same thing or go through the same thing. I don't know. It's a possibility, I guess.
It is, you know, and you have to look at, you know, I talk about the horrible experience I had at that initial animal neurologist, but, you know, maybe that's the push I needed to question it all, to defy the prognosis and say, no, I refuse to accept this. You know, maybe if it was a very warm and loving atmosphere, you know, environment, we might have been more comfortable with saying, okay, we've done what we can, but it's time to put her down. So, you know, everything happens for a reason. I'm certainly a strong believer in that. And so, you know, maybe that's why that all went down the way it did.
Could be. And I know in your book you mentioned, like, one of the first days, Renee was kind of down, and that's when you were, like, saying, no, we're going to stay positive. So did that, over the course of you know, the whole rehab, were there any moments where you were close to just saying, you know, screw it all, or throwing in the towel? Or because, again, I don't want to go into too much detail, but it does seem, I mean, you know, there were some setbacks, but for the most part, it seemed like a pretty straightforward recovery. But did you have any backslides or any moments of depression?
So thankfully the rehab, once we got it going, then we didn't have any setbacks. What we had was times of overwhelming stress. The rehab was 3 hours a day for months. I can't remember how many months we did that routine of up an hour before work to do the hour of rehab with her, another hour as soon as we walked in the door after work, and then another hour right before bed. And then, you know, sleep for 6 hours, get up and do it all again the next day for months. So things got there were time, and then, you know, the rehab was very expensive. The trips were expensive. We were at a point where we were going to sell our house because we just couldn't pay for it anymore. There was never a point where we said we're going to stop. There was never a point where we said we were going to give up or even think about it. It was never even discussed. But we certainly reached breaking points. Thankfully, we never, you know, went all the way over one of us were able to kind of pull the other one back and say, hey, it's not as bad as it seems. Here's how we'll get through it, that sort of thing. So it was a test of our marriage that ultimately made it stronger. It surprisingly in the long run put us on a kind of better path financially, only because it forced us to really understand the importance of having a savings, importance of having that money set aside for emergencies, and prioritizing things. We weren't we weren't super thrifty at the time. We weren't irresponsible by any means with our money, but we didn't understand at the time the value of having that rainy day fund, so to speak. So, never any time where we were going to give up, but certainly there were lots of times, especially in the earlier first month or two of rehab, where we had to kind of pull each other from the ledge.
And now, with this experience too, do you think this, because you, like you said, at the time, you just had your pets, no kids. What was it, 2010 when you had the first child?
2011.
Do you think this experience helped prepare you for parenthood? Because, I mean, even with pets, taking care of them, but you can set out the food for the, for the dog or cat. They can eat when they want. You can just take them out. But now with having to kind of give 24/7 care to Keegan, did that help you with parenthood?
I really do. I don't think it's a mistake that just two years after her the year-long process that we went through with her, that then we were ready to start a family. And we always joke because our rescues, they all came from very unique backgrounds. They all had issues. At one point, we had more dogs wearing diapers than not wearing diapers in our home. So we joked that, we'd stop and look around at our brood and say, look at this. These are just animals. What would we do with a child? We'd ruin it, And so we didn't feel ready. We didn't even really entertain that. But this experience, the constant care that we had to give, certainly proved to us both that we were ready to raise a child. Which we were right, because we've done a fantastic job. Now we only have the one, so but certainly I think the experience taught me a lot about what I was able to go through, the inner strength that I had, and the confidence to say I could be a father and care for a young person that can't care for his or herself.
And how many, do you have any pets now? Because I know the story, minor spoiler, the story does kind of end on a down note with the story of the pets.
I don't think it's a down note necessarily. So we have one left of our original nine.
Okay.
Now it's been 10 years, so that's to be expected. Unfortunately, animals' lifespans are not all that long. But she's 16, and it's our elder cat, who you may remember, because I acquired this cat from our days together working at an ABC affiliate in Carterville, Illinois.
Yeah, I remember. I remember the story. Well, I know the story you tell in the book, and it did seem kind of familiar. But I was a little jealous that Sandy Mann, our former coworker, got a mention in the book, and Kevin and I did not. So I was waiting for the WrestleMania 27 story to pop up, but I guess that was a few years later.
Yes. Well, had you brought me an animal,
I was the red rooster.
So this is, when I said earlier, animals eventually find you, I think maybe it's people with animals find you, because Sandy knew that that we rescued animals, and they'd found a kitten without the mom was gone and it was under their porch, and her husband was allergic to cats and they couldn't keep it, so she brought it into work, and the rest is history. Here she is now 16 years later as our final cat. But you know, it's funny, we're actually just getting ready now that Lucas is 7 and able to help out with things around the house. We are this fall going to the shelter here in South Florida, and we're going to rescue a dog, so we're about to start round 2.
Okay. And you know, in Florida, even though you might see them and they may be injured, saving rescue alligators is not a wise thing.
You know, we've never turned away an animal that shows up on our doorstep, and literally there's an awesome story and a photo to prove it of an animal that showed up at our doorstep just waiting for us to answer the door. So I don't know. I can't make any promises that if a wounded gator shows up at our door, we're not going to at least consider letting it in to help it out.
Yeah, I saw a picture the other day, and I don't know if you saw this. It was a Texas A&M student took a graduation photo, like, petting an alligator. Like, not at a gator farm, but, like, standing in the lake, and the gator's got its nose out. I don't think it ended as badly as the girl who decided to take the photo with the sharks. But I really question some of the decisions being made by the youth of today.
You know, I've really enjoyed our time here in Florida. I'm very excited to be down here. But every now and again, when I see these gator stories, that is the one time I question, why South Florida? What was I thinking? Yeah, we're pretty leery of the gators. We try to steer clear whenever possible.
Yeah, I mean, are you close enough to the Everglades for the pythons?
No. Well, I mean, it's close, but we haven't ventured over that way. So haven't seen any pythons, but we have seen quite a few gators, and we've had a big one right near our house in one of the canals. So they're big.
Yeah. Well, I've always been told if you don't bother them, there's no guarantee that they're not going to bother you. But
exactly. Yeah. That's
yeah. All right. I'm trying to think if there's anything else to wrap up the Keegan story, because, again, I don't want to give out all the details. I think you wrote a book that is very captivating, and as I originally said, if I had an attention span, I would not have been able to put it down. But when I did actually start reading it, it took me probably 3-4 hours amongst everything else that I was doing to complete. It's a fascinating story. It is a page turner, and yes, you tell some, you weave in the stories of the other animals as well. Go ahead.
That just kind of happened organically. I certainly, you know, Keegan is the central character in the narrative, and as I, you know, told the story, as I started writing it, I just kind of kept going back and forth to some key moments in the past, and it was kind of to understand how we got to this place, you need to know where we came from, and so the other animals were such a central figure in our lives for so long as well, and so they certainly became supporting cast members that were very, very important to all of it. You know, I mean, I don't know. People go a long way to help their animals, which is so fantastic. You know, I having 9 animals in a house is pretty crazy, and I think that we had to be that crazy to kind of go on this journey. Yeah, I'm glad, you know, I'm glad that I'm finally telling the story. I kind of referenced the time that it took to write the book in the book because, you know, once things finally settled down, it was like the scene in Big Fish, you know, that Tim Burton explains that, you know, when time stops, what they don't tell you is that it speeds up. It felt like that because life got very busy after that, as if, you know, we'd put everything on hold for almost a year to rehab Keegan. And then after that, it was off to the races with our lives again. And so, you know, writing the book kind of more became, I'm going to try to keep jotting down these things as they come to my mind and just the important elements that I want to remember. And then, you know, in the last year or two, I've revisited that with a conscious effort to finally get it completed into a book. And I was surprised at the end with it being 10 years, I was surprised at how raw the emotions still were. And I think I referenced that towards the end as well. I bawled writing the last couple chapters, and the reflection, and you know, that all those emotions, they still 10 years later just still feel just like it happened yesterday. It was such a bonding experience with her, with Keegan, that so many wonderful animals that I've had in the past, so many wonderful animals that I will no doubt have in the future in our family, but I don't know if I'll ever share a bond with any of them like I did with Keegan. It was just such an amazing journey, and I'm just so excited that I now have an outlet to tell it.
Nice. Now, after writing the book, reflecting on everything that happened, is there anything, looking back, that you say, oh, we should have done this instead, or is there anything you would have changed if knowing that what you know now?
Boy, that's a good question. You know, I just feel so fortunate that we were lucky enough to find Dr. Frick when we did. I wish we would have found her a little earlier. I think that Keegan's ultimate prognosis would have been a little better had we found her right away. And you know, I was frustrated that the neurologist in St. Louis didn't know about the specialist just 30 miles down the road. Had he recommended her the weeks earlier, because I think it was another several weeks before we ultimately got down to see Dr. Frick. But again, it was out of our hands. I don't think I could have done anything. I was doing the research, and it just took the right search words, the right keywords to then for her to pop up in my research. So no, it was just the world of down dogs is such a strange world and complicated world, and we navigated it just out of the blue with the other chaos in our lives and our everyday lives still happening as well. So things I wish would have happened differently, yes, but things that I said I wish we would have done different, personally, no, I don't think I would have. I think that we handled it as best we could have with as much grace as we could have. I'm so thankful for the people that supported us during that time, and of course I reference that in the book as well. But as the bond that I had with Keegan and the story that I can now tell, obviously I wish it never would have happened at all, for her sake. But certainly, again, everything happens for a reason, and everybody came out of it a little stronger. The line, "Nobody told me my legs don't work," came from the amazing spirit that Keegan had throughout this whole process. Even in the beginning, when she didn't know what was happening, she just was so sweet through it all. And I always said, "Oh, nobody told you that your legs don't work. You still try to get around and crawl around." And so that kind of turned into, I want to write this book, and this is what I want to call it. That's where the title came from, because I said that to her on a number of times.
Nice. Are there any plans for another book? Not necessarily a follow-up, obviously, for this one, but do you have any other ideas that you would like to put down?
I do. I actually have started writing it, and it is a fiction, and it's from an unfinished, half-written screenplay that I started years ago, that involved a child star that died. That was the inspiration for the screenplay, because we've lost so many child stars through the years. That's just a population that we continue to use and abuse and then turn away from when society fails them. And so that was kind of the inspiration to sit down and just start processing through that. And, you know, I'm a child of the 80s. I love film. And so to see all of these, you know, actors that you grow up with go the way that they go, and to see society turn their back on them, you know, it's hard to see that. And so that was the inspiration for the screenplay. I think part of the thing that halted the writing process back then was I realized I will never produce this. And so, you know, I like to produce short films. And so that kind of it kind of halted the writing process a bit as I decided, do I want to continue to write a full-length screenplay with the worry that nothing would ever happen and it would just sit on a shelf? And then in the process of finishing Keegan's book, that's when I, you know, decided that I'd like to take that half-written screenplay and turn it into a novel and then finish it and give it the it's just due. So, yeah, that is the next project on the horizon.
All right, that sounds interesting. I will definitely be reminding you every 6 months to ask you where it is so that you can read it.
Excellent. Well, I will get to writing fast and furiously on it.
Nice. Just don't call it Fast and Furious. Is there any last words, anything you want to say to pet owners, to people thinking about pets, to, well, really to anybody? Do you have any last words?
Well, I think that I know that there's a desire for specific breeds. I know that oftentimes they might make more well-behaved pets or have a certain type of personality that people are looking for. But boy, I mean, rescue pets, they can give you something that, you know, that you don't get when you buy from a breeder. And that's that, you know, just unflinching loyalty and a look every time you look at them that, you know, almost like there's a little twinkle in their eye that knows that you saved their lives. And there are just amazing animals across the country in shelters that are just waiting for somebody to come in and give them a home and love, and they want to return that love so bad. So if it's companionship that you're looking for, just you know, looking for a wonderful animal, then please visit your local humane society, your local animal shelter, and you know, give a shelter pet a try, because they certainly are amazing creatures, and they will never forgive you for it.
Great advice. And where can people find the book, and what is the name of the book one more time?
So the book is Nobody Told Me My Legs Don't Work, and it's available in print and in digital, in all digital formats, no matter what your reader is. It's out there in a format for you. It's available on Amazon. It's available on BarnesandNoble.com. It's available on Apple iWords, Kobo, Smashwords.
So there's no reason not to buy it.
No reason not to buy it. If you'd like to see it stocked in your local bookstore, just ask them. They can. It's published through Ingram Group, and so if they have requests, they can fulfill those orders at any time. So you can ask your local library if they'd stock it, and hopefully they'll take you up on that as well.
All right.
So easily accessible. I have a website, travisceyates.com, that has a little bit more information and some photos. Some photos from the book, some photos that didn't make it into the book. So you can check out more information on that platform as well.
All right. Once again, Travis, thanks for joining us. It's always, like I said, a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm sure you'll be back sooner rather than later. And
thank you so much for having me and allowing me to again, share Keegan's story. I think that's ultimately what I'm most proud about is being able to share in her story of just the amazing spirit and her will to never give up during the whole scary process for her. So I appreciate it.
All right. And if the Dolphins make it to the Super Bowl this year, we will have to go. So we'll see each other there.
And next year, they're hosting, or 2020, they're hosting. So let's chat about.
We know they will not be in the Super Bowl that year. All right. As always, as we say every episode, question everything, do something positive.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. for more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.